Great, thank you for the introduction. Thanks for inviting me. I know it's kind of busy right now, but I appreciate you coming out, taking the time to listen to me. So last time I was here, I sort of tried to paint a very general picture about sort of my perspective on the general structure of entanglement in local quantum systems. And so today I'm going to say something a little more concrete, although not exceptionally more concrete, but somewhat more concrete. Okay. So here's some experimental data that motivates a lot of what we do. So what's plotted here is a function of magnetic field, the Hall resistance of some two-dimensional electron system. And what you see is that there are these little plateaus here, like this, these precisely quantized plateaus. And these plateaus correspond to some very precisely quantized value for the resistance, the Hall resistance. Right? This is a formula for the Hall conductivity, where you apply a voltage one way and measure a current the other way. And these integers nu, these numbers nu are very precisely equal to certain simple rational numbers. Okay. So this state is a very interesting state. It's some kind of, you know, you can get states where nu is an integer if you are filling up more lambda levels. So you have some strong magnetic field, right? And you have electrons. So you have number of electrons and number of flux quanta. If this filling fraction is an integer, you get the integer quantum Hall effect, right? Where you get some standard E squared over H conductivity. If you lower the number of electrons or increase the magnetic field so that you have only electrons in the lowest lambda level, then interactions become important. You get some interesting collective state. And here's a way to understand that state. So in this collective state, the electron is actually broken up into three pieces. And we can represent that by writing the electron operator as a product of three other fermions. And because the electron charge is minus one, the fermion charge will be minus one-third. So this total object has charge minus one. And the important thing about this formula is that there's an SU3 redundancy. So I can take these Fs, these so-called partons, and I can rotate around in their flavor or color index with any arbitrary SU3 matrix, and it leaves C invariant. Okay. And the really cool thing is that even though it's a one-third filling, there's exactly one electron for three flux quanta. So if you try to put the electrons into the lambda level, then it's massively degenerate. But these partons, they have one-third the charge. And so there's one parton of each color for electron, and each parton has one-third the charge, and so its lambda level is exactly the same as the number of partons. Right? So these partons can nicely fit into a single lambda level. Right? And so what this means is that the low energy theory of this system is actually basically these SU3 charged partons in an integer quantum Hall state. And yeah.
This is a very naive question.
Sure.
Should I think of those Fs as being identical or as being different?
Well, so they're different, but they're not different in a necessarily meaningful way. I mean, there's this SU3 which you can rotate between them. Right. So there are three colors, but what you call red, green, and blue, or whatever, you know, one, two, and three, that differs.
Irrelevant. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's some redundancy, so you have to form gauge invariant operators. And
well,
only
unlike,
ask about those.
Unlike identical particles, they're not, you're saying.
I mean, they have a color, so they're not strictly identical.
They do have a color.
They have a flavor. So if the gauge field is weakly coupled, you can treat them as if they have some extra flavor. Okay. And so these fermions are coupled to an SU3 gauge field, which implements this gluing. So it glues the fermion, these partons back into an electron. And the low energy theory is deconfined SU3 level 1 Chern-Simons theory. Okay, so this is just some word. It doesn't really matter if you know what this means. But the interesting thing is that you can very easily now figure out what the conductivity would be. So we have three colors of these partons. Each has charge E over 3. And they're each an integer quantum Hall state. So they each contribute E, their charge, over 3 squared over H, right? And then there's sum over 3 of them. So for 1/3 squared over H. Right, so this picture naturally reproduces the Hall conductivity at nu equals 1/3. And more interestingly, there's also this fact that if you take this system, this nu equals 1/3 topological liquid, and you put it on a space, you put it on S2, you get one ground state. But if you put it on, say, a torus, you get three ground states, right? Or if you put it on a, you know, a double torus, like a big double donut or something, you get nine ground states. And these ground states are unlike symmetry-breaking ground states. They can't be lifted by any local perturbation. So there's something very special happening here. One other piece of interesting physics is that if you terminate the system at an edge, instead of putting it on a closed surface, there are edge states. So this res stands for reservoir. So you can imagine doing an experiment where you sort of put electrons in here and take them out here at these different chemical potentials, mu left and mu right. And if you imbalance these things, so that effectively there's a voltage this way, then you'll have a current flowing from one reservoir to the other, sort of along the edge. So that's, again, the Hall effect. So this is kind of crazy. How can this happen? I'm claiming that we have some system of electrons where, you know, the charge is not one anymore, it's one third. And there's SU3 gauge fields and these edge states and so on and so forth. So how can this happen? And it clearly can't be similar to something like a lattice of hydrogen atoms a centimeter apart, right? That's, you know, the electrons sit in the hydrogen atoms, they don't talk to each other, they don't do anything. That's a product state. Just electron and hydrogen atom and that's it. And furthermore, it can't be obtained, whatever this state is, it can't be obtained from such a localized state by any kind of adiabatic evolution for a finite amount of time. You'd have to evolve for a time which goes like the system size or longer. So what it means effectively is that there's entanglement. Quantum entanglement is playing an important or critical role in this system. We call this long-range entanglement because of this criteria that you can't remove it by any short-range sort of adiabatic evolution or quantum circuit, if you like. So from my perspective, you know, quantum Hall physics is sort of like this amazing gift from, you know, the Platonic world or whatever, this amazing thing. And so because quantum entanglement is so important for the existence of this phase, I think that's by itself reason enough to study this thing. So let's talk about this proposal. So I said there was long-range entanglement, but how do you quantify that? Well, you can compute the entanglement entropy. That's what I do, is compute entanglement entropy most of the time. So here's the definition, right? And Levin, Wynn, Kataev, Preskill showed some years ago that there was a way to extract some topological feature of the system from just the ground state wave function. So you can imagine all these regions are much bigger than the correlation length of this system. And you compute the entropies of all these regions and subtract them in this particular way, and you get some constant, minus 2 log curly d, which is supposed to be some thing which tells you about the topological order. And so this constant would vanish in a lattice of hydrogen atoms, but it's non-zero here. More generally, there's this concept more recently introduced of entanglement spectrum. So here again, I have my region of interest A and some bigger subregion B, I mean some bigger sort of environment B. L is the linear size of A. And what I do is I compute the reduced density matrix of A by tracing out the external world of B. And I can always write this thing. This is just some, you know, density matrix. I can always write it as exponential of some operator. But this is just a definition of what KA is. But the important thing is that the fact that the entropy of this state goes like the boundary very roughly sort of suggests in some very crude sense that KA is like a local Hamiltonian at the edge of A. Somehow, you know, it should sort of exist on the edge of this space. Very, very crudely. In fact, we know this is not really true in some examples, some gapless examples. But for gap systems, maybe it's a pretty good sort of thing to think about. And so you might ask, you know, is there a relationship between this thing and the physical edge? Okay, so we're going to address those questions, but I just want to pause and give some other motivations besides this interesting, you know, characterization of these topological phases. There's a, you know, related thing is the characterization of spin liquids. You know, you often hear it said that spin liquids are things which don't break any symmetries, but that's a very negative characterization. So if you want to see a spin liquid, you have to just check every possibility in, you know, whatever you're doing, your quantum Monte Carlo or whatever. And if you don't see anything, then you say, okay, maybe there's a spin liquid. But here we have some proposal where you can actually. There was some proposal where you can actually compute a number, and if it's not zero, it's a spin liquid. right? And so recently this has been done, at least sort of, for some models I'll talk about later on. And I think this is also important because in principle, you can have spin liquids coexisting with symmetry breaking. You can have fractionalization and symmetry breaking coexisting. There's no reason why that has to, you know, they have to be exclusive. So you really need some way to say that fractionalization is there without saying they're just not breaking any symmetry. Okay, so there's a lot of other interesting things that you can think about. So that this justifies you inviting me here to hear what I have to say. So here's what we're gonna consider mostly. We're gonna talk about, this is where the geometry comes in. We're gonna talk about, you know, robust features of the entanglement spectrum for states of matter whose low energy theory can be approximated as some Lorentz invariant theory. Okay, and I'm always gonna consider A and B regions, which are like these semi-infinite planes, these semi-infinite half spaces, right? So, and X will always be the you know, normal direction here. Okay, so this would be like a half line or a half plane or, you know, half space, whatever. Okay, so here's the sort of topics. That was a kind of introduction. So once again, entanglement spectrum, this is the definition again. This is just sort of saying what I already said. So, as I said, for gap systems, maybe this entanglement Hamiltonian has a real chance of being interpretable as a local object on the boundary, something like that. And I already told you these quantum Hall states are extremely interesting, so let's think about them. So, a few years ago, what Lee and Haldane observed is that if you look at, say, the nu equals 1/3 Laughlin state, and you compute the entanglement spectrum, that it's gapless just like the physical edge. So, like, if you took a disk and you look at the entanglement spectrum of a disk, it looks like in the eigenvalues of that Ka that there's some boson, which is chiral and which is going through zero energy, right? So there's a gapless boson. And it also works for non-abelian states. And maybe most interestingly is that, you know, there's a suggestion that this can be a reliable signature in small system sizes, like exact diagonalization or something like that, where you can, it's sort of known local information that may tell you more about what phase you're in than you know, some other less non-local probes. And it's more information than entanglement entropy. It's sort of, you know, a lot of counting states, it's telling you what the spectrum looks like. So there's a lot of information there. Some other details. So the state counting, you know, sort of Virasoro levels, that's all reproduced. It sort of knows, you know, what CFT it's talking about. It's not just some mess. And that, you know, these people argue that there's some sense in which the low energy part is universal, or the form of it is universal, or maybe the state counting is universal. But there's also finite size effects. So if, you know, you put it on a disk, you see the fact that it's not an infinite CFT, but not an infinite line, but some on some circle. And most importantly, especially for thinking about physics, you know, we know the physics of the actual edge is very complicated. You know, you can have all kinds of things happening there. So what this claim is really saying is that only some kind of very minimal set of data is reproduced. That's necessarily, that's the observation. Not that, you know, that it's actually the same as the physical edge in any system, but that, you know, because you can always add perturbations to the physical edge and change the story there. But it's a minimal set of data, some topological data which is reproduced. Okay. So what's sort of been done here? So this has been generalized, this conjecture has been generalized and proven for some class of materials called topological insulators, which are, these are materials where you have some band structure, and the band structure has some topology associated with it, and that topology guarantees that you have edge states or surface states, so long as you respect some symmetry. There are also physical arguments for fraction quantum Hall systems. We're gonna sort of give another argument for this based on this geometric approach today. And I also want to mention that there are other cuts that are interesting. So here we're cutting in real space, but you could also cut, like, if you had a, you know, if you had two spin half chains next to each other, you could cut, you know, along, you know, the bonds that tie the chains together. So that's a different, that's not a real space cut, that's some kind of, you know, interchain cut or something. And these are also quite interesting. Okay. So that's kind of the background. So we're going to try to talk about. So here's some geometry. This is Minkowski space, 1+1-dimensional Minkowski space. So I put, this is a space-time diagram, I put x here and t there. right? And this red line is just showing you an example of a particle that's sitting at rest, right? And the blue line is a particle that's moving with some speed v, this guy here. And everything's in terms of the proper time tau. And I can move from red to blue by boosting. So I call the boost generator k in anticipation of a relationship that will appear momentarily. Okay. So suppose I'm in this situation, this Lorentz invariant situation, and I have some quantum field theory on Minkowski space. Well, what's the entanglement spectrum of the half space? Can I answer that question? Well, the answer is yeah. Actually, I can answer that question. Here's a way to do it. Think about this as a Euclidean sort of path integral here. So here's x and here's Euclidean time. And you would normally think of preparing the ground state. So here's the ground state living at this point by some Euclidean time evolution this way, right? But the insight of these people is that actually you can do it a different way. You could also prepare it by sort of starting here and rotating like that, right? So like a kind of transfer matrix picture, if you like. And so blue is the time translation picture, and red is this sort of boost picture, except now I'm in Euclidean space, so a boost is a rotation. And so you can compute the wave function here, the wave function of the fields living in the plus side and the fields living in the minus side, that's this guy, as a kind of transfer matrix, if you like, of the field starting here, evolve for an angle of pi, right, that's 180 degrees, and then ending there. Right, and now if you put the bottom on there, if you add this the bottom here and then go around again and sum over the minus guys, then you get this is the answer for the density matrix of this half space. Okay, so that's it. Now, this was known for many years, but now we want to claim this tells us something interesting about quantum Hall states. Okay. So before I go on, let me give a little bit more intuition for what's going on here. This is a picture of the same space-time diagram, again in Minkowski space now, so I'm in real time. And there's this region called the Rindler wedge, which you can see here. And this wedge has a special property that if I know the state of x greater than 0 at time 0, then I know all the physics in this region. Right? So you can see if I sort of start here and send a light signal, it goes parallel to this line, I can never get into this region. So all the physics here cares only about what happens on this sort of surface right here. It doesn't care about what's happening on this surface. And so it turns out that an interesting fact about Rindler space is that it's a space sort of seen by accelerating observers. So you have these uniformly accelerating observers. So before I showed you observers who are either at rest or moving with constant velocity, but now they can uniformly accelerate. This is what their x and t look like. And the velocity, sort of the physical velocity, goes from -1 to 1. So they start out, you know, moving this way, almost the speed of light, and then they end up moving that way at the other speed of light. And the answer to this question, what region of the spacetime do they have access to, is again the Rindler wedge. So that's what these curves here are. These are the world lines of uniformly accelerating observers. Okay. And A, the acceleration labels what world line you're sitting on. And so these observers see just this Rindler wedge. And at the same time, they also see, so they only see the Minkowski vacuum, right, restricted to this half space. That's all they have access to. And so this is essentially, you know, the fact that accelerating charge or accelerating particles see some radiation. This is this old fact. Okay. So here's just some details of, there are these light cone coordinates, which I defined earlier. T plus x and t minus x, which are very convenient. And these boosts act on them in some way. This is just details. It's not so important. But here's an explicit expression for the generator in terms of coordinates. So it's x dt plus t dx. And the important thing, as I just said, is that this k acts like a generator of proper time translations for these accelerated observers. So it just moves them along their world line as seen from their own internal clock. And just to return to this point now, how does this observer describe the vacuum? Well, the vacuum is, you know, Minkowski vacuum is Lorentz invariant, so the boosts don't do anything to the vacuum. But more importantly, if I boost by, instead of a real boost parameter, I boost by an imaginary boost parameter. This is 2 pi I. And go back here and look. If I do this and put lambda equals plus minus 2 pi I, then nothing happens. Right? So this is analogous to saying that if I, you know, if I'm in a finite temperature state and I send all my times to, you know, T plus I beta, nothing changes. Right? There's this periodicity in imaginary time. And so you have the fact that the state is invariant and that the coordinates are left invariant by this particular complex boost. And this is all consistent, again, with a state in this Rindler wedge, which is thermal with respect to this matrix K, this operator K with temperature 2 pi. Right, so observers, accelerated observers see thermal radiation. So again, that's consistent with what we had here. The temperature is 2 pi in some dimensionless units, and the Hamiltonian is K. Okay, so let me just sort of pause here for a second and give some overview. Okay, so to get the operator form, all we do is just take this boost generator at t equals zero and evaluate, you know, plug in for dt the energy density. Right, so all you do is you take x, which is this coordinate normal to the boundary, and you take the energy density and you integrate this over all x. That's the answer for the entanglement Hamiltonian of the half space for any Lorentz invariant theory. Now there's some other things I'm not going to explain how to get these things. They follow from the first result by a conformal transformation. So this only requires Lorentz invariants, but if you also have conformal invariants, so like you're at a critical point, then you have additional results. So for a disk or a ball, you also know what the entanglement spectrum looks like. You have an expression there. And furthermore, there's a nice additional fact that you can also compute the entropy of a disk directly. So forget about the whole spectrum, you can just compute the entropy by calculating the partition function of this relativistic conformal field theory on the three sphere. Okay, so this is like Euclidean three sphere. So again, so for any Lorentz invariant system, we have the half space entanglement entropy or entanglement spectrum. For a conformal system, we have the disk as well as the half space. And also for a conformal system, we can directly access the entanglement entropy by computing this partition function. So this is a lot of, you know, fancy, if you will, you know, field theory stuff. But the point is that what I want to claim, so let me just also make this note, you know, that you need some UV regulator, that x equals zero, there's some issue. But what I want to say is that, you know, if the theory you're caring about, the low energy theory, is Lorentz invariant plus irrelevant perturbations, well, then you can still use this technology, especially if that theory is gapped. So here's sort of the idea. Let me just do the entanglement entropy first. So let's consider, again, the fractional quantum Hall state. So I told you before, it's described by some Turin-Simons gauge theory. And in a path integral formulation, what happens is the number of ground states on a surface is just given by the partition function evaluated on that surface times S1. So think of this as like taking the trace of e to the minus beta h, but where h is 0, and all you're doing is counting ground states. That's all you're doing. And I should just want to point out that Z is topological. It doesn't care about the metric at all. So it's also trivially conformally invariant. I mean, that's a simple statement. It's a conformal invariant system where the correlation length is zero instead of infinity. That's the other fixed point of C goes to lambda C, zero or infinity. And so if we can ask about the entanglement entropy of some region A, and the answer is that it's some non-universal number, A, alpha here, times the boundary, the size of the boundary, minus a universal number called beta. And what beta is it's just the number of disconnected boundaries times the log of this little curly D that we met earlier. Okay. This curly D has a name. It's called the total quantum dimension. And it's also related to something called the modular S matrix, which we'll meet in a second. So this is sort of meant as a review. So here's this, you know, setup again. So region one, okay, it has two boundaries, one, two. So that means it's going to have a minus log two or minus 2 log d, right? Region 2 has only one boundary. So that's minus log d. This is minus log d, and this is minus 2 log d, because again, it has two boundaries. And these sort of the links are all chosen so that they cancel out in the calculation. So the boundary law terms all go away, and you're left just with this universal minus 2 log d, which is some topological thing. And the way that Levin and Wynn computed this was using some model wave functions. And Kataev and Preskill used topological quantum field theory arguments. Oh, they also actually, sort of interestingly, they had an early version of this bulk edge picture where they said, suppose that the Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian is like the Hamiltonian of an edge, then you get this result. So they observed that it works, but they didn't go any farther than that. Okay, so now I'm gonna tell you a new way to compute this that we showed how to do. So the idea is you can make S3, that's the what we want to compute, is the three sphere, right? And the three sphere is like all of space, except where if you go in any direction, you come back to the origin. So it's like a big ball where you squinch all the stuff at infinity to a point, right? And so you can think about making that by taking two solid donuts, right? So here's my hands are solid donuts, linking them in this way, and then expanding them to cover all of space. Right? So you just have your two donuts that are linked together, and you blow the donuts up until they touch each other, and then they cover all of space. Right? That can be done. And you're allowed to deform the donuts, right? It's topological, so it doesn't matter. Right? So these are donuts. If you take a disk, a solid disk, and you multiply it by a circle, you get a solid donut. And you can interpret the partition function of this solid donut as like a Euclidean path integral, which is giving you a state on the surface of the solid donut on the torus, right? So you just think about, you know, evolving an imaginary time out. You get to the surface of this donut, and you have some state there. So this is some state, and because this partition function is one, remember there's only a unique state on S2, because this guy is one, and because I can make S2 times S1 by taking two disks and gluing them together. Right, so I take, you know, just take one disk and another disk, and I just put them together, and that's a sphere. So I can get this S2 times S1 by gluing these two guys together. And that corresponds to just taking the inner product of these two vectors. So this vector is normalized. And furthermore, it has trivial anion charge because it's just, there's no Wilson line inside the bulk. Basically, there's nothing happening inside the solid donut. So if you took another particle around, it wouldn't see any flux. But this gluing, where I glue the sort of the tori, the boundary tori together, that doesn't give me S3, it gives me S2 times S1, right? So what you can do is instead you can exchange the cycles of the torus, right? So you have your donut. I can draw a picture. So here's the torus. You identify these two things. So here's one torus, here's the other torus. So at first you glue them together and you get S2 times S1. But if you instead switch these two cycles, so you rotate this by 90 degrees, and then glue them together, you actually get S3. Okay, so you can go home and think about this. I don't want you to try too hard to visualize this, but I mean, it took me like a couple of days with my hands to figure this out. So, of course, Witten knew this already, you know, a million years ago. It's in some paper of his. Although he didn't call entanglement entropy, so okay, we can still write a paper. So anyways, the important message is that what implements this exchange is something called the modular S matrix. It just exchanges these cycles, some CFT technology. And so you get some matrix element of this S matrix, and that gives you the conformal, this quantum dimension. So the purpose of this slide is just so you can go home and play with your hands a little bit, and also to impress you with my ability to say fancy words. Okay. So there's some other way to compute this thing, right? So that's nice. So this sort of formalism sort of checks out. It makes sense. Okay, what about the full spectrum? Well, so the idea is very simple. I told you what Ka is for Lorentz invariant case, and all I want to say is that Ka is more or less the same thing as a physical Hamiltonian with an edge. That's it. Okay. And so we know this thing for any phase, gapped or gapless, doesn't matter, as long as it can be approximated as a Lorentz invariant. And like I said, we have further information if there's conformal symmetry. So here's just everything together. So here's a representative, a Lorentz invariant representative of fraction quantum Hall physics. It's just the Chern-Simons term. If you don't like this, you can think instead of some Dirac fermions coupled to this gauge field, which you integrate as, right? But it's clearly some Lorentz invariant representation of this physics. And I say, okay, this is my entanglement Hamiltonian, right? And the spectrum of this is the entanglement spectrum. And so first of all, there's this cutoff, as I said earlier. And then secondly, you can think about this sort of, interpret this locally. Suppose there's a big gap. What is this X dependence doing? Well, it's just making the gap bigger or smaller, sort of locally, right? If you go far away, there's a bigger gap. If you get closer, there's a smaller gap. Right? That's sort of the local interpretation of what this thing is doing. And then as you go to X equals zero, the gap is disappearing, right? So it's like you have Dirac fermions, if you like, with some position-dependent gap, which then vanishes at some point. And then beyond that, you have nothing. Right? And now it's well known in 2 plus 1 dimensions that if you have Dirac fermions with some mass and you terminate the mass somewhere, you have a domain wall or something like that, there's going to be edge states. More generally, this partition function here, this Chern-Simons theory, if you have some edge of the theory, you have to put some boundary conditions there, right? You have to put gauge invariant boundary conditions. And these invariably lead to some physical, some CFT which lives at the edge of that system. Right, and importantly, okay, so this, I mean, I'm not claiming this is what the actual entanglement spectrum looks like, you know, in the actual quantum Hall realization, right? But these boundary, these chiral boundary states are completely robust to all perturbations, all local perturbations. You can't do anything to get rid of them without changing the whole state of the bulk, right? So it doesn't matter that this is not exactly what the real entanglement Hamiltonian looks like. All that matters is that it has the property, these gapless edge states that I can't get rid of. And you can also do more complicated things, but we'll talk about that. So here's a little further statement about this. So, you know, I computed this for this Lorentz invariant case, or I looked in the literature and there's an answer, and you can then read it off. But the important question, the important thing I would say is that if the state is some gapped state of a local Hamiltonian, then I can take the Lorentz invariant theory, which is where I know the answer, and I can add some irrelevant perturbations to it, which let me put it on a lattice. Right? But these irrelevant perturbations, there's some UV, some short distance UV physics. And furthermore, there's a gap in the state. So I can fiddle with the UV Hamiltonian a little bit, and I can, you know, fine-tune these perturbations away to make it a very Lorentz invariant, or I can put them back in. Right? And this is all implemented by some local unitary transformation, right? So I can add these relevant perturbations by adding this local unitary transformation. But for a gapped phase, I would definitely say that what happens is, you know, you change the density matrix a little bit, and that changes the entanglement Hamiltonian a little bit, but that change is local. That's a claim which I will stand behind. And if that perturbation is local, then it can't destroy the edge states. So I think I would say that if you want to think about a gapless system, then maybe there's a little more subtlety in this argument in terms of, you know, if I have some irrelevant perturbations that are going to zero at the you know, critical points, but, you know, how exactly safe is this unitary transformation that I'm doing? But at least for gap things, I think it's totally okay. Okay, so this is all just to say that I have an expression in the relativistic case. I know what it does. on very general grounds, and I know how to take it to the non-relativistic case by adding these relevant perturbations. And I know that these relevant perturbations, they can't destroy the gapless edge states. So therefore, the non-relativistic system has the gapless edge. And of course, I only talk about quantum Hall here, but actually this method works. It sort of encompasses all the other states that people have considered up till now and new ones. So we sort of took all the proofs and put them together. Okay, so but now let me talk about this issue of phase transitions. So far we're talking about gaps, topological phases.
Hey, Brian.
Yeah.
This technique, it isolates the universal term somehow, and it doesn't care about the boundary divergence, like if you're computing entanglement entropy.
So yes.
It somehow just knows how to isolate it.
Well, I mean, so there's some there's some junk associated with the fact that there's also, you know, the bulk gap is also closing, right? You know, it's like, it looks like, you know, another way to interpret this x is that you're raising the temperature locally as you get closer to x equals zero. So, you know, eventually your temperature is going to get bigger than your fermion mass, your Dirac mass, and it's going to look like a CFT, right? So there's always this non-universal boundary law contribution, which you get. But the claim is that in addition to this, there must be this chiral edge, which is always there. So in that sense, it isolates. You know, it shows that this feature is there. Yeah?
So I just wanted to point out a reference that you might not be aware of.
Okay.
About 5 years ago, I wrote a paper with some students in Eduardo Bradkin, where we computed entanglement entropy for Trans-Siemens gauge theories.
Yes, I think I know this paper.
Well, arbitrary Trans-Siemens on arbitrary spatial topology and arbitrary entanglement regions. So anyway, we use surgery methods. One of the features of the result is that the entanglement entropy depends not only on the modular S matrix, but in cases where you have degenerate ground states, the entanglement entropy knows about which linear combination states you take.
Like I said, the calculation I did, I was getting a particular state, which was the state that has, if you pick an anion around, this cycle doesn't detect anything. Mm-hmm. Right, but yeah, I completely agree with you in general that if you compute the entanglement in some linear combination, it can depend on the linear combination. I wasn't trying to claim this is some new thing. I'm just showing that our methodology agrees with existing results.
And this entanglement Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Is that, can you think about that in terms of the conformal block structure?
Yes. So that you can count states. Right, you know, different energies, and this should reproduce the counting of conformal blocks.
But what information about the conformal blocks does it carry?
Well, it carries the state counting, at least. I mean, yeah. So at least, you know, if you look at some large but finite circle, and you look at the entanglement spectrum, then it's going to look like, you know, just the CFT Hamiltonian on the circle, with these right number of states at each level, and these dimensions appearing. So I think what exactly is universal or not universal about this thing is not completely settled, but that, I think, part is reasonably clearly established. Okay, any other questions? Okay, so again, we were talking about topological phases, gapped phases, and how we can characterize these things with their entanglement entropy. So here's another example of such a thing. This is, again, like this hydrogen atom story that I was telling you about earlier. These are, you know, think of these as bosons now. They're all sitting in their little positions, and they don't move, right? So this is a localized product state. This is called a hot insulator. And for our purposes here, it's not interesting. because it's just a product state. But there's another possibility related, which is like a kind of cousin of quantum Hall physics, where what you get is something called a topological mod insulator. So here what you should think of happening is you should think of the physical boson, which I call phi, is fractionalizing into two copies of some fractional boson. Right, so this is just like the fermion goes to three copies of the fermion, now the boson goes to two other bosons. But this decomposition has a redundancy, right? I can send b to minus b and it doesn't change phi. So there's a Z2 gauge theory now instead of a SU3 gauge theory. So this is an interesting phase. It's gapped. It's not adiabatically connected to this short-ranged or localized state. And it's described at low energies by a deconfined Z2 gauge theory. So that's just another cousin of quantum Hall physics. In fact, it does not have protected edge states in this case, but it's still an interesting bulk phase. But we can also ask about phase transitions. So if you take this phase here and you compute at the same entropy, you get minus log 2. That's what this log d is. Just d is 2 for this state. But we can also ask about phase transitions. And this is a zero temperature phase transition, let me remind you, where what happens is you go from some topological mod insulator to a superfluid. So you can think of the topological mod insulator as being stabilized by some interactions that cause the bosons to want to sit, you know, or to do some kind of, it freezes out their charge motion. And if you turn these interactions down, then what happens is the bosons form a superfluid. Right? We all know that if you put some bosons, if they're weakly interacting at finite density, they form a superfluid. So there's a transition from topological mod insulator to superfluid, just a conventional superfluid. Nothing special about this superfluid. But unlike the mod insulator superfluid transition, which is a condensation of a charged scalar field, so it's an XY transition, here what's condensing is not the physical boson, but these fractional bosons, little b. So this is why it's called XY star. Star means you put some fractionalization in there to make things more interesting. Okay, so what this transition, the properties of this transition are kind of nice. So the critical exponents nu and z, so this is what controls the divergence of the correlation link as a function of the tuning parameter towards the transition. And z is a dynamical critical exponent, so that tells you how time and space scale relative to each other. So these are the same as xy, but the anomalous dimension of the order parameter is much bigger now. And the reason why that is morally just because the order parameter is a composite field. So it's b squared, where b is the xy field. It's undergoing this condensation transition. So it's some composite field in that xy critical theory. And so its anomalous dimension is large. And we know entanglement characterizes the topological mod insulator. I told you their script d was 2. So what about at the critical points? And the answer, remarkably, is that it actually knows the difference. So now if I think about smooth regions, again, linear size L, in this gapless theory, and again, we're in 2D here, then you have this boundary law term and then minus beta, and this beta is some universal thing. And furthermore, this beta is shape dependent. So whereas in the topological theory, beta only cared about the topology of the region, here beta cares about the shape of the region. And so let's call beta xy, whatever this thing is, this function of the region shape, this universal function of region shape, whatever it is at the xy critical point, let's call it beta xy. Our result is that at the xy star critical point, the beta of xy star is beta of xy plus beta of z2. So it just adds. And so in particular, this part depends on shape, but this part doesn't. And we computed this in two different ways. The first way was using an exact wave function in a certain limit. So if you take the extreme deconfined limit, where basically in the gauge theory there's no electric field term, then you can write down the exact wave function of the system. and you can compute the entanglement entropy exactly in the sense that you can tell the difference between xy and xy star. So I can't tell you what xy, what its entanglement entropy is. That's a complicated, hard to solve problem. But I can tell you that xy star is xy plus log 2. And then we also use this, we also get some argument based on this, because this xy star theory is also a conformal field theory. It's just the xy theory coupled to a discrete gauge field. So if you send the gauge field, if you send the sort of defect mass in the gauge field to infinity, then it's a conformal field theory. And so we also computed it in this, via this method, and we got the same answer. Okay, so we believe, recently people have been thinking about, you know, studying these xy star critical points in quantum Monte Carlo, so we think we have a prediction now for, well, if they know what xy is and xy star, then we think the difference is going to be log 2. Okay?
So this two-gauge field remains gap at
yes.
the critical point.
Yeah, the visons stay gapped up to the critical point.
Okay. And this finite beta z2 is the contribution of the gapped gauge field? Is that what you said?
Well, in the topological case, there's really sort of two contributions. You can think of it as, but basically it's the statement that the strings, there's still some kind of closed string constraint. That's where this log 2 comes from in the topological theory, is that, you know, if you have strings coming in and going out, you have to have an even number of strings coming in and going out. So it turns out that even though the charges are fluctuating in some way, that this sort of log 2 survives.
Even at the critical
points. Okay, so what should you remember? I think first thing is that the entanglement cut is like a physical cut. So, you know, we call this, just focusing on subregion A, that's the entanglement cut. It's not doing anything, just tracing out B. But apparently it's behaving very much like a physical boundary. The second lesson is that the ground state knows about the dynamics of the edge. That's a kind of surprising thing. But it does appear to know about those dynamics in the sense that there's some necessary components, these gapless chiral edge states that have to be there. And the ground state knows they have to be there. Lesson three is that entanglement can distinguish critical points, quantum critical points, from each other. That's another nice fact, because as I said, sometimes these things are not very hard, but they're somewhat hard to distinguish. You know, maybe they have some critical exponents the same. And then just sort of more generally, it seems like entanglement and geometry are very tightly bound. So here we gave some kind of geometric argument based on, you know, Lorentz transformations. But of course, there's this whole story about ABS-CFT and various other interesting things. So it seems like these really are somehow very closely related, which is pretty interesting. Okay. So I just focused on quantum Hall, but it applies to a huge class of examples. And the same is true for that xy star transition. Basically, any transition where you have bosons coupled to some gauge field, then this sort of method will work to tell you what the difference between the beacon function, the transition and the transition star, what their entanglement properties are. So some things you might think about are numerical computations of entanglement entropy by sort of putting the system on hyperbolic space and directly simulating that system. So you can look for the thermal, you can look for the energy eigenvalues, and those are the eigenvalues of the entanglement Hamiltonian. Right, so you have some lattice that mimics hyperbolic space. Another thing is entanglement spectrum-inspired variational states. So we already have entanglement entropy-inspired variational states. But the entanglement spectrum is sort of more information. And so actually, it's another story, but I would sort of argue that the MIRA is actually sort of maybe the best suited tensor network. Yes, you phrase happy, but in terms of sort of the structure being what you expect to give you these spectra. But that's another story. Okay, so there's also this issue of replica phase transitions, because you know the full spectrum, you can try to address this question of you know, if I calculate the Renyi entropy, that something interesting happened as a function of the Renyi parameter. And then finally, some interesting thoughts about people have been using this trick. Rob Myers and various other people have been using this trick for gapless phases, where it's sort of it's most powerful. But we care a lot about finite density. And it doesn't directly work at finite density, but maybe some trick you can play, which we're working on, to address finite density. So you could, for example, I could tell you the entanglement spectrum of a Fermi liquid instead of a topological theory, maybe. All right, so thanks for listening.
Any questions?
Okay. For like 11-1 models, or like mutual or transitive theories with K minus K.
Yeah.
Or maybe just stick with 11-1 models, or maybe there's not edge modes.
Yes.
But does this kind of procedure kind of tell you? It tells you how to compute the entanglement theory, right?
Yes.
Do you have a perspective on how it's telling you entanglement theory, but it's only information about the bulk? Because it's, you see what I'm saying? Because the entanglement Hamiltonian is a bulk feature instead of maybe the edge feature.
It's a bulk feature.
The entangled spectrum, it doesn't distinguish between topological phase with and or without edge modes, this procedure.
The spectrum without edge modes will be mostly unremarkable.
Yeah.
I mean, there may be some topological degeneracy associated with these ground states, but yeah, it won't be that interesting. So that's a true statement. But yeah, so then you have to, this Z of S3 trick is more convenient there, because you can just, focus on this particular state that you get by this Euclidean path integral, and you can compute the entropy directly. So somehow that trick removes the boundary wall junk. And if you properly normalize the partition function, it removes the boundary wall junk, and then you can get the answer you want.
Okay, and you're also working on when you break the Lorentz invariance by a chemical potential?
Yeah. So, it's this same kind of picture applies, that now you have to add minus mu J0, and then you need to do this path integral, this angle order path integral. But the generator is not the same at every slice. On the other hand, we know, J0 is a pretty simple transformation law under boosts. So you can still make some progress with that formal expression. But we're not sure yet. Looks like, Hamiltonian is going to be non-local now, at least a little bit. So we don't know exactly how to deal with that. But yeah, it's work in progress.
More questions?
Is this singularity at the cot can be treated in the same way? The presence of chemical potential?
Yeah, that's another issue. We're not sure. It seems like maybe you have to impose some condition that there's no current coming out of that point. That's the right Hunter condition, but we're not sure yet.
Any other more questions?
Let's thank Brian again.